Okay, thanks a lot. It's a great pleasure to be here. I was enjoying my time here, and I hope, well, to talk more to people here in particular. That's one of the purposes of giving this talk. And this will be a review of the work I was doing over the last several years with a bunch of people, most notably with Vitya Garbenko and with Rafael Flauger. And the title of this talk is a semi-joke. It's a somewhat sad semi-joke, but I think I have a right to do it because I was making this joke also before it was known that it's sad. So, and it mainly refers to the fact that, well, we chose to work at energy scale, which is kind of three orders of magnitude off from the choice of most other phenomenologists. And one may discuss how wise the choice was, but there is one advantage of working at that scale is that empirically it looks like the number of papers in this energy range roughly proportional to the energy. So down to 750 MeV, it reduces to the number so that I can read all of the papers which come out. And I think that's already good. But jokes aside, the main underlying question which drives what we're doing is what is the physics of Young-Mills theory, pure Young-Mills theory, in the limit of infinite number of colors. So this question is old and famously hard. So my main goal for this talk would be to convince you, well, it's an interesting question, and it's also maybe a good time to think about this question now. And I will be using somewhat restricted and at the same time somewhat ambitious notion of what I mean by interesting question. So first of all, should be questions so that one cares about the answer. So second, that's where it will be restricted. So it's put upper bound on how interesting question can be. So I will insist that it's sufficiently sharply posed. So the answer should exist. Actually, it often happens in physics that most interesting questions are such for that there is actually no answer. I think like 100 years ago, the example of such a question would be, what is the orbit of an electron when it rotates around the proton in the hydrogen atom? And famously, well, there is no good answer to this question, but thinking about that question, one learns quantum mechanics and many other things. I think modern analogy, that question that kind of question would be what an observer who feels in black hole, what an observer who falls in the black hole, what he experiences. I suspect that there is a similar story going on here. So the question I will be discussing here is not that interesting. So I think there are good reasons to think that this particular question has an answer. But also, and that's where I will be somewhat ambitious, that I will try to convince you that actually, given that question is hard, so there is a path to find the answer, or at least to make progress right now, and that's why I think it's a good time to work on this question. One sharp version of this question would be the following. So this is the plot from a very recent paper, like a couple of weeks ago, by Mike Tepper and Andreas and Senadora, who measured spectrum of globules in, they were doing lattice measurements in glue dynamics, in three-dimensional glue dynamics. Of course, on lattice, they do a finite number of colors, but for all practical purpose, you can think of it being infinite, so they do up to something like SU16, and there are around 50 globules shown here with the mass determination of the mass accuracy of mass determination of order like few percent. So for all practical purposes, in a sense, this is the answer to the question. So one version of the question would be to calculate these masses. And these guys calculated these masses and masses and quantum numbers. So of course, what I mean by answering this question, not just calculate them using lattice, but understand at least qualitatively, the pattern of the quantum numbers here. And so I will try to convince you that, that there is it's very likely that one will learn some interesting physics while doing that. Uh, Well, and of course one can go to 4D. Just lattice data is not so good in 4D, but there is data there. So that's kind of probably that's at the current stage that the most ambitious goal of this program is kind of to understand this pattern of quantum numbers and masses, which is shown here.
Can I just ask a question?
Yes, sure.
So in 3D, these blue balls are localized objects.
Yes. Yeah, these are particles. Yeah.
They're particles.
Yeah.
And what is there any naive expectation of what this atom should look like? I mean, you don't expect strings, so.
Well, yeah, let's come back to the my next slide.
That's
so.
In 4D, right?
Well, but also, I don't think it's not that different from 3D. No, these are strings. So yes.
Yeah, so, even in 3D.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yes.
So you expect Reggie trajectories in 3D?
Yeah. And, well, you kind of see. Well, this is zero. This is two. So this is a leading Reggie trajectory. So.
But they have different quantum numbers. Aren't they supposed to have the same, parity and so on the same?
Oh yeah. So these guys. So there are lots of different. But so this is 0++.
Oh, it is.
This is 2++.
Oh, fine. Sorry.
So this is 4++.
Yeah,
plus.
Coloring somehow doesn't show that.
Yeah. Well. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. But yeah.
So you say they. So it would be helpful to draw the lines to guide the line?
Well, kind of that's a work in progress, not the correct way to draw lines. But yeah, but clearly one can draw the leading Reggie trajectory. Well, there are only three particles here, but they kind of look at to be on the straight line.
I see. So that you would predict one at 6?
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
And that's within, that should be, so there are a lot of predictions would come out of it.
Yes, but so that's one of the goals here to kind of find a consistent picture. For sure, yes, one of the points of this slide that there is lots of data here, but maybe not directly experimental data. It's lattice data, but it's high quality and it's about the theory, which is not infinitely far from what we observe experimentally. So, So one reason why I think this question is interesting, yeah, because as Neil said, we have the project for the answer to this question. So the project is that it should be a series of strings. So we have good. So now this shows instead the spectrum of this is Rho-Mason Reggie trajectories real world QCD. So one sees a beautiful straight line here. So that's one. So one evidence that we really see relativistic strings here, and of course one also sees them. On the lattice, so we have really good reasons to believe, and we know that QCD is a series of strings in certain regime. That's the best language to describe it. There is no reason to get excited every time you hear that there is a string there. So, well, there are various kinds of strings. There are strings in abelian Higgs model, well, which may be interesting, but I think their interest is limited. I think what's special about this kind of strings is that also there is a natural limit, namely that's the limit of large n when the strings becomes free strings. And free means here that they're probabilities, if you have crossing of self-intersection of a string, the process of emitting a closed loop is suppressed. And so that's what makes these strings really interesting. So in that sense, they're closer to fundamental strings, and we have a hope really to understand what these guys are. And kind of zeroes out the question, so can we solve this free string theory? By solve, I mean calculate the spectrum of states. So that would be that's one way to phrase this question sharply. So our approach to solving this question, to addressing this question, would be to divide it into two parts. So part number one, and that's actually most of my talk will be about this part number one, is let's first try to understand the physics of infinitely long strings. So if you're in pure global dynamics where there are no quarks, then if the confining string it cannot break. So, in principle, you can imagine a universe which has infinitely long string stretching through that universe. And for many reasons, this is actually a simpler object to understand than a short strings which are supposed to describe glue balls, because here I'll talk more about that. But it's essentially a system of Goldstone bosons. And it's more symmetric configuration. So the first step would be first to understand Wolschmidt theory of such an infinitely long string. And the second step, which actually Well, we just since probably other people thought about this before, we just are starting to think about that now. But the question would be, let's say you know everything about this theory on the bullshit of infinitely long string. So knowing that, can one calculate now the spectrum of globals, which is a spectrum of short strings? And as far as this question is concerned, I think, well, I'm so far very confused about that. That's, there is more guesswork than like some consistent approach. But that's why I mostly focus on question number one for this talk. So just to be a little bit more specific, so I'm repeating really what I already said, but just to be more specific what I mean by theory which lives on the infinitely long string. So if I have a theory like Peyurian-Mills, so namely it's a confined gauge theory with a mass gap, so there is a mass of the lightest particle not equal to zero, and there is, well, technically what's called unbroken center symmetry, but in practice in pure fluid dynamics, it's again, there are no fundamental charges, so string cannot break. That, as I already said, that one can consider a configuration where one takes infinitely long flux tube, and in such a configuration, one may think about this configuration as like analog of brain world. So if one looks in the theory in this background, then there are four-dimensional excitations which propagate in the bulk. But at energies below the mass of the lightest global, which also set by scale of lambda QCD, so the only excitations which are present in the series, these are translational modes on the string, and there could be additional modes which are localized on the string. So one has effective two-dimensional theory which describes dynamics of the object at low energies. And that's true for any number of colors. So zeros out the question would be, what is this theory? Again, something more interesting happens when one takes the planar limit. Because what happens at infinite number of colors, if one starts with this two-dimensional theory, if you're a two-dimensional person who built a collider on the bullshit of the string and you're colliding excitations of a string, then the energy of collision reaches the mass of the lightest particle in the bulk, you'll start producing particles in the bulk. So the theory is no longer two-dimensional. However, now when one takes the planar limit, then the in the large NC limit, so this scale remains constant, and also the mass of the globals remain constant. However, the cross-section for producing these particles which live in the bulk, it's suppressed by 1 over n. So effectively, the regime of validity at any finite value of n, the regime of validity of this two-dimensional theory becomes larger and larger. I think that's the interesting, that's another way to say what makes it interesting, this setup where there is a limit when theory becomes free, because now one can take the order of limits by first taking a limit of infinite n, and then one gets a two-dimensional theory which is valid up to arbitrary high energies. And so what we are trying, like the question number one, which I was referring to, it's really the question what this two-dimensional theory is. And there are reasons to expect, in particular, that shall partially try to explain in my talk, that this theory is very interesting on its own right. So it's has unusual asymptotic behavior in the UV, which has to do with this funny way of constructing this theory, that one takes infinite and limit first, keeping energies fixed. But on the other hand, there is this theory definitely exists, and there is a very practical way to study this theory, again, on the computer. So I think that's one of the few quantum field theories for which we have, really, from physicist's point of view, absolutely rigorous mathematical definitions. maybe not from mathematician point of view, but at least practically, like people doing lattice simulation, they know that this path integral for the theory is defined and then calculated with arbitrary precision. And so we know this object exists we're talking about here. Yes?
So this is scale lambda is the mass gap, and lambda n is the energy that takes to break the string.
Yeah, so that's the energy where the two-dimensional unitarity breaks down, where the processes with production of globals in the bulk becomes unsuppressed. If you collide something on the string, so above this energy, there is no four-dimensional
so is
theory.
Is there a way to understand from QCD naively independent model that this you know, this breaking of the...
Well, there are several ways. The way we estimated it, we just count, like if you have infinitely long strings and you take a look at the typical stress, the excitation of a string, well, it's kind of, it's a long string, you can count the number of self-intersections, and during each self-intersection, the probability of closed loop to go in the bulk, it goes like 1 over n squared. So from imposing that, that's a probability becomes sort of the 1, you get this scale. But there are other ways to estimate the same scale. So essentially, for instance, one can, so that scale also matches the following. So if you compactify your theory on a circle and you ask, well, theory is asymptotically free in the UV, so at what circle size the theory becomes weakly coupled to theory of KK bosons. One gets the scale which goes, but it's the same scale, is NC over LS. So, for instance, the scale is important for many reasons. For instance, there was an argument in the early 90s by Joe Palczynski, who was arguing that most likely the theory on which lives on the bullshit of the string is most likely would be a theory with infinite number of fields. Well, we don't think so at the moment, and I think the resolution goes, because his argument was exactly to look at the behavior of a theory on a very small circle and count the number of states, and there was a discrepancy. But I think the resolution here that one should be careful with taking order of limits. So what Joe did, he basically, first he took the limit of infinitely small circle, and instead what we're doing now, we it kind of it fixed circle size or it fixed energy scale, we first take and to infinity limit. So so our expectation, and I think so far it matches what one sees on the lattice, that actually this theory may be relatively simple, but maybe Joe is right, so he's smart. So maybe we're missing something here, but that would be, hopefully we'll see it eventually. I think there are reasons to expect this 2D theory to be relatively simple. Very naively, because at the end of the day, what one the UV theory, the bulk theory, is asymptotically free in this case. So we take some finite limit in this asymptotically free theory. So in particular, theory of blue balls, it becomes really free theory. So one would expect also this two-dimensional theory to be somewhat simple in the UV. So that's that's a question which we should be able to again see observationally, experimentally with using lattice data. So as I already said, so that's, I'm just repeating myself, but yeah, so the way, if you affect the field theories, and that's what makes this theory, this limit nice, then at least at low energies, this theory on infinitely long string is just a theory of Goldstone bosons, which corresponds to spontaneous breaking of bulk Poincaré symmetry to two-dimensional Poincaré and transverse rotations. And so many properties of this theory can be understood in this language. And it's already telling you that it's an interesting two-dimensional theory, because since Coleman and Merman and Wagner, we know there are no Goldstone bosons in two dimensions. So this is an honest counterexample to that statement. So this is a really honest theory of interacting Goldstone bosons, and I will illustrate it later using kind of what can derive from current algebra thinking about this theory. So this is, so we kind of know how to work with this theory at low energies. To get some idea what one may expect at high energies, it turned out to be useful to ask the following question, which may be not immediately obvious if it's the effective field series. So are there integrable series like that? And by integrable, I mean, so there are, in two dimensions, there are these special series which are non-trivial, but particularly simple. So there are series without particle production. My next question, okay, are there series of Goldstone bosons without particle production with this symmetry breaking pattern? And there are several reasons why to ask this question. So first, if one finds an answer, what would be a concrete example of a series like that? So one might get an idea what to expect. Another motivation was coming from recent progress in understanding Henneckel 4 superion mill. So by now, there's at least one example, actually more, of high dimensional conformal theories, which are integrable in the sense that one can calculate the spectrum exactly. So it's natural to ask, are there integrable confining theories? And I think in a situation like that, when there is a two-dimensional theory which lives on a Wolf sheet of a string which is associated to four-dimensional theory, so natural definition of integrability would be requiring integrability on this Wolf sheet theory, just because for two-dimensional theories we know better what integrability means. Well, and finally, as I already said, so one might expect that QCD string should be somewhat simple at high energies. So maybe simple translates in integrability. So that was kind of another rationale for asking this question. So the answer turns out to be yes. If one assumes that there are no extra particles in this area apart, in addition to this Goldstone bosons corresponding to the breaking of translation symmetry. So one can show using word identities of nonlinearized symmetry, of the nonlinear Poincaré symmetry, and imposing addition requirement of integrability, that it's only possible at d equal 3 or 26, so if only one considers string in 3 dimensions or in 26 dimensions. And also, it's an interesting example of a theory where, just again, where we can like bootstrap program to some extent works 100%, so one can restore the full S matrix just from imposing symmetries and integrability. So the S matrix turns out to be very simple, so it's a just phase shift. So in integrable series, everything is determined by 2-2-2 scattering. So in the 2-2-2 particle scattering, there is a phase shift, which tells us there is a time delay. So all what happens, there is no even reflection. So particles go through each other. There is a phase shift. And there is a technique known thermodynamic beta ansatz, which is the box which allows, if you know exact S matrix, it allows you to calculate the spectrum of a series in finite volume. So if you apply this black box to this S matrix, you get this answer. And here, if you ever opened any string theory textbook, you would immediately recognize that actually this is a spectrum of critical bosonic string when d is equal to 26. So this question about integrability, it captures some series which we think are interesting. It's d equal to 26 case. What I'll try to argue, now that actually, well, this answer, that kind of one reason why I think it's also interesting to look at what happens in QCD, because this answer, in spite of its simplicity, it's a very interesting theory. So, and I'll try to convince you that it's better to think about this theory from many points of view, not as about conventional quantum field theory, but more like about integrable quantum gravity. So I think the fastest way to see that there could be a relation with gravity is to recall that, well, actually, there was some other place in physics where this kind of phase shift was found. It's, if one looks at the iconal scattering in high dimensional gravity in the regime of a large impact parameter, so it's kind of boring regime where there is no black hole production, so then one finds exactly the same answer. And actually, like recently, there were lots of progress in, surprising progress in finding a relation between chaos and physics of black holes. And essentially, there are two ingredients in that story. One dynamical ingredient is this phase shift, and another kinematical ingredient is extra large boost coming from the presence of a black hole horizon. So this setup, as far as I can tell, we don't have the second ingredient, but this phase shift is exactly the same one. So that's one kind of fast argument to see why there could be some relation to gravity. But at more detailed level, so what are the physical consequences of this phase shift? Well, first of all, if I collide two excitations on a string, this phase shift results in a time delay, and this time delay grows with energy, which is very unusual for quantum field theory. In quantum field theory, if you collide hard stuff, that basically particles go through each other. So here, phase shift grows indefinitely. And actually, one may compare, so this time delay, that's exactly what one expects in two-dimensional quantum gravity. If you form a black hole and black hole Hawking evaporates, the Hawking evaporation time would be proportional to energy in 1 plus 1 dimensions. Furthermore, there is equivalence principle here, namely this phase shift which one has here. That time delay is the same no matter whether I take a single hard particle or if I take a bunch of soft particles with the same energy, total energy. And that has to do with the fact that the phase shift is linear. It's e to the s. It's linear in the Mandelstam parameter. Finally, there is this phase shift gives a very concrete meaning to what people sometimes call string uncertainty principle. Namely, what one finds here is that if one starts with two wave packets, two arbitrary wave packets, and looks at the collision, and happens the result of this collision afterwards, then there is an uncertainty relation limiting the widths of the outgoing wave packets. So namely, the product of the widths of outgoing wave packets is always larger than LS squared. So this is a very practical sense in which this theory looks non-local. It doesn't allow to probe physics at distances shorter than LS. Just you're trying to collide particles at high energies, but the wave packets which come out there, they spread so much that you don't get any information about local physics. In one way to say what's interesting about this theory, so this is an example of a theory. So we used to, like conventional quantum field theories in the UV, they describe by fixed points, by conformal field theory, so it's by scale invariant fixed points. So every memory of the scale, intrinsic, like of mass scales which are present in the theory, it gets lost when it goes to infinitely high energies. So this is an example of a theory which doesn't do that. So one way to summarize why all those properties were possible is because there is always memory of this intrinsic length scale which built in the theory, so no matter how high one considers the energy of colliding particles. And related to that, and related to this S matrix, it has essential singularity at infinity. It's exponentially exponential at large energies. So related to that, these conventional methods to reconstruct local observables from S matrix fail here. So there is good evidence that this theory has no local observables. So it provides a very kind of operational meaning to what non-locality means. So it's a theory, we have amplitudes here which are defined up to arbitrary high energies, but just they don't allow to build objects which would be conventional local observables. So it's a new type of asymptotic behavior, we called it asymptotic fragility for various reasons. So what makes QCD string interesting, that I think there are very good reasons to think that it also would be a theory, the two-dimensional theory which I was constructed from QCD taking this large n limit. It would be theory similar to this one, at least that it won't have conventional UV fixed point. If so, that would be, again, it provides example of operational way to construct non-integrable theory like that. Hopefully it would be more similar to gravity. So, well, we know there are many interesting relations between gauge theories and gravity, and so maybe that's another one. So the theory which lives on the Volt sheet of a confining string in many respects looks like a gravitational theory. So for me, probably that's one of the main interesting, at least originally. I never cared too much about QCD in my life. For me, it was kind of boring subject which has to do with backgrounds at the LHC. So before I started thinking about that, for me, the main reason which drove me in this field was kind of this. But by now, I am kind of becoming QCD aficionado on its own. That meant to explain one reason why I think it's interesting to understand theory of QCD string. It's likely to be very unusual and interesting two-dimensional theory. So let me now get back to how one can make progress and what we know about this theory at the moment. Let me get back to 750 MeV boson. I think it looks rather hopeless to make progress. Well, it's definitely a very hard problem, and many people thought about it, how to describe theory of confining strings. For me, it looks hopeless to make progress without experimental data. And there is experimental data. As I said, there is lattice data. I've shown for you the spectrum of globals, but there is also lattice data which measures directly properties of long strings. So what people do, put theory on a cylinder. Well, on a computer, it's always in finite volume. So here you take advantage of that. And instead of measuring a spectrum of globals, they measure spectrum of excitations which are created by strings which wrap around one direction on the cylinder. So once it's better to think on lattice, everything is Euclidean, but it's better to think about this direction as being spatial direction, and this is time direction. So one studies this kind of correlator of two loops which wind around the compact dimension. And from that correlator, one may extract information in the limit when the size of the cylinder becomes very large. one can extract information of about the theory which lives on the Volt sheet of infinitely long string. So that's how people do it. Like that's kind of experiment we're using. And this is a slide which I already shown. So to compare this experiment with a theory, at least at for long strings, one thinks about these long strings as a theory of Goldstone bosons. And then the question is what lattice people measure. They measure the finite volume spectrum of this theory. So they put it on a circle. So one has information about finite volume spectrum of this theory. And now the task is to extract from that measurement information about this theory. So it turns out, because of symmetries, there is a huge amount of universality in this data. So in particular, if one looks at the ground state energy, so it's just a kind of straight string wrapped around the compact dimension, then the conventional method of kind of calculating these energies was expansion in the size of the string over its tension, so taking the LS over R as a small parameter, where LS is the width of the string, or lambda QCD. And then it turns out in this expansion, if one looks, for instance, at ground state energy, but it's also true for excited states, there are first like four terms, they're universal. So it means, well, they are assuming that there are no extra massless modes, these terms just follow from symmetries. So the first term is just classical energy of a long string. It's proportional to the length. The second one is a Casimir energy, which is known as Luscher term. But also kind of third and fourth term are also universal here. And for ground state, this expansion works very well. So what's shown here is data. And this is sum of the line here is the sum of universal terms. So it matches data beautifully. And I should say, I subtracted, when I showed the data, I subtracted the leading term here. So you don't see linear growth because if I added, because it's by far the largest term. It's really small correction, and you wouldn't see anything. So actually, this is a bad news because that tells you that ground energy, at least ground state energy, is a very bad observable if you want to use this measurement not to test kind of that you understand things or not to test that actually, well, these numbers, they are what they are. But if you want to use this measurement to learn something about this theory, because, well, it just looks completely hopeless to get information from non-universal terms here. So fortunately, situation is better for excited states. So what's shown here, the green is again, is the energy of the ground state is a function of string lengths. And these are states, energies of the states which correspond to you. So we have this string which wrapped around a circle, and you have now you added a phonons, so wiggles propagating on the string. So this is one wiggle, this is two wiggles, which are just left movers which propagate in one direction. And so here one sees something interesting happens. So there is data here, then solid lines are the sum of universal terms again, which for long strings, of course, as it should, it matches data. But for shorter strings now, it doesn't match that well. But another interesting fact is that, well, actually, there is this dotted line here, which matches this data much better than the sum of universal terms. And this dotted line is just the spectrum of bosonic string. If you kind of close your eyes, that you in four dimensions, so the theory is non-critical, and do light cone quantization, which is the wrong thing to do because it breaks Poincaré symmetry. But if you just plot the spectrum, it looks like a perfect fit for the energies of these states. And something even more interesting happens now for the states where, so here what I did, I now took a string and I put two phonons on the string, but propagating in the opposite direction. So it's kind of mini collider. So you're really colliding particles now. There are three collision channels, which are characterized by symmetry properties with respect to rotation around the string, which is O2.
So yes. You talk about data, sorry, is it like string data or QCD data?
No, it's all QCD. So what one simulates QCD, but then one, of course.
3D.
Huh?
3D.
Sorry. This is all 4D. In 3D, well, these two pictures would be very similar. So this one would be more boring because there is just single channel there, actually. There is data there, but for 4D is much more interesting. So yeah, here for now, we'll be talking just about 4D. Yeah, that's a good question. Thank you. So in 4D, the group of rotations in transverse direction is O2. So correspondingly, there are three different channels. So there is a scalar, spin 2, and pseudoscalar. So one finds here, so first of all, this conventional perturbation theory, which is a less over expansion, is completely useless. So it produces these two curves. And there are two of them because it predicts that scalar and pseudoscalar are degenerate between each other. Furthermore, some of the levels, they still, like dashed line here, is still the spectrum of light cone quantized bosonic string. So some of the levels sit pretty close to that one. But some other data actually are pretty far from that. So something more interesting happens here. So that all these observations was a motivation to look for some better way to calculate, especially this slide definitely suggests that there should be better calculational scheme which would explain why wrong theory produces such a good agreement with data. And clearly what happens is that honest perturbative expansions becomes asymptotic in this regime and badly divergent. So we were trying to look for a better way to do this calculation, and the idea was, well, just to look at the spectrum of, first let's look at the spectrum of a critical string. Imagine we were doing the same thing, the same kind of calculation in critical string where we know the answer. So how would one understand why there is such a big difference between energy of the ground state and excited states? So what one does in this context is just, well, one takes this square root and expands in LS over R. And the difference is that, for ground state, like n and tilde is equal to 0, and the radius of convergence for this function is pretty large. However, when n and tilde is not equal to 0, there are additional terms here which are proportional to 4 pi, or 2 pi, and 2 pi is a large number numerically. And so the radius of convergence here gets much worse, and so for strings which were measured on the lattice, this expansion is not convergent. However, physically we know where this 2 pi is coming from. These 2 pi, factors of 2 pi n over r, these are momenta of particles which propagate along the string. These are momenta of phonons. Somehow the physical idea was that one should think about energy of excited string as really being a function of two independent quantities, physically different things. One is the energy of phonons which propagate on the string, and second, well, there is genuine finite size effect. So what conventional perturbation theory does, it plugs, instead of P, it plugs 2 pi over R, and then expands everything in less of R, that way mixing kind of contaminating the whole expansion by these factors over 2 pi's. So we were looking for the way to calculate the finite volume spectrum, which makes it manifest that really there are two different physical parameters here. And it turns out that thermodynamic beta ansatz, which I mentioned to you, that's exactly this kind of method. So basically the idea is that one first calculates scattering amplitudes for infinitely long string. That's where perturbative expansion enters. That's where one assumes that energies are small. But then in principle, one can go at least as soon as theory is integrable, and it turns out to be integrable here at low orders in perturbation theory, one can go from S-matrix to finite volume spectrum exactly, and that way one disentangles these two expansions. So that's just what I just explained. There is a messy set of equations which correspond to this. They have simple physics there. So the main point here is that if you put quantum mechanics on a circle, then free particle quantization conditions that momentum is equal to 2 pi n over r, it gets modified by additional phase shift. And including that phase shift, that's really the main effect here. So including that phase shift improves the convergence property of the expansion. Using that method, what one finds, so for instance, for these states where one has only left movers, what one finds that these dashed lines now, the prediction of kind of the same. It's the same calculation. We didn't introduce any new parameters. What we did, we kind of calculated phase shift at leading order in perturbation theory, and then plug it in thermodynamic beta ansatz equations. And one works. One finds that it works well for vacuum state. For ground state, it worked well before, and it works as well now. But for excited states, it works much better. So dotted lines here. This is really well. This is zero order approximation. In this case, it's just adding to ground state energy. Just energy of a free particle, 2 pi n over r. So that really tells us that these states are very boring. So it's as expected. So it's just a ground state with a phonon propagating in one direction. So the dashed line is including the leading order so-called winding corrections. And as it should, it works much better. And that actually corresponds to the answer which one gets from light cone quantization. So it explains also that miracle. So light cone spectrum, light cone quantization produces the same answer as the thermodynamic beta ansatz with the leading order phase shift. So these are boring states. Now, if one applies the same thing to states where particles actually collide in, where one has particle collision, then one finds it doesn't look that good yet. So there is still prediction that scalar and pseudoscalar should be degenerate. But on the other hand, at least at this point, it's clear that it's this state which is off. So actually before, when people were looking at this plot, they're saying, oh, maybe actually this state doesn't look that bad with this perturbation, these two red points, at least the blue line. So here it's clear that the difference between the red data points and these two, the theoretical lines is much larger than the uncertainties related to perturbation theory. So it looks hopeless to resolve this discrepancy just by doing next order perturbation theory. On the other hand, one immediately sees that these points also, they have interesting pattern. Well, namely, they have very boring pattern. So this, when one has here the energy is a function of the size of a string, and it's practically it's horizontal. So it looks like if you have a string and you just added a particle on top of it, so the total energy gets shifted by the mass of that particle. So it does look like the state corresponds actually to, it indicates the presence of a massive state, which is localized on the string. So it's not just massless mode there, but a massive one. And so one can add this guy and this. This is a pseudoscalar state, which is equivalent for O2 group. It's antisymmetric tensor with respect to O2. And the mass of the state happens to be 750 MeV. So as I promised, my title was accurate. And well, one can also determine from this data, so there are two new parameters here. So the mass of this guy and the coupling constant. So from lattice data, one may determine both the mass and the coupling constant. And well, this was our first paper on this. We had this number. And this uncertainty is only statistical one. There's systematic and theoretical uncertainty, which is roughly 10 times larger than that. So we know this coupling constant at 10% precision. That will be important momentarily. I think it's fair to say that's kind of the current status experimentally what we know about this theory. So we know, and well, it doesn't look, at least so far, it doesn't look like there are any additional massive states. And for instance, scalar channel, there are more levels which I didn't show here. So one can go up to masses, at least maybe factor of two larger than that. There is no sign of any extra massive massive states. In three dimensions, actually, there is no sign of any massive particles localized on a string at all. So one can measure phase shift. It's not e to the s. So there is, we know kind of from lattice data that theory. So remember, actually, e to the s was a possibility in three dimensions. So that was also allowed to have integrable theory consistent with Poincaré invariance in three dimensions. But from data, we see that that's not the case, not surprisingly. So that's as far as experimental status goes of what we know about the theory. But then we try to get some theoretical understanding of what this particle could mean. It's a bit of surprise that it's a pseudoscalar. So if somebody asked me before what one expect to find on a string, I would say, well, something like a Brizian mode, something like a scalar Brizian mode. And instead, this is it's a Brizian mode, but it's a kind of Brizian mode with a twist. So it's a pseudoscalar. And one question we asked, kind of coming back on the serious side, so I told you, so integrability is not possible if one doesn't add any extra new particles. But the question was, well, is it possible if one adds new particle on a bulk sheet? Can one restore integrability? There is a simple option to do that. So one can add a scalar and couple it in this way. It turns out if a scalar is massless, then actually this theory can be integrable. It's the same S matrix, but just one has initial scalar particle now localized in a string. And this is a somewhat complicated way to rediscover, which is very well known to string theorists. It's called linear dilaton background. But it was a sanity check, again, that this question about integrability, it captures interesting known theories. It turns out one can play the same game with a pseudoscalar. One can add a pseudoscalar now that one has this coupling which is kk tilde, where k is the extrinsic curvature of the string. And it turns out if there is a massless pseudoscalar, or more generally in a general number of dimensions, what one needs to add antisymmetric tensor with respect to a rotation group in the transverse plane. So instead of adding a scalar, one adds an antisymmetric tensor. Then again, one can restore integrability. And integrability would require the value of this coupling to be this one. And this is the same coupling which we already measured before on the lattice. And surprisingly, it turned out that these two numbers, they agree within error bars. Which in practice probably means, again, as I told you, this is just statistical error bar. So in practice, it means at the level of 10%. There is a joke that whatever you do in QCD, if it's not completely crazy, it should work at the 10% level. This was surprising. What could this mean? And I can see three possible explanations. For first, as I said, it's numerology. It's possible. So it's just we're not understanding something. And there could be some down-to-earth explanation to that, or Prince Zeta signed how it's like Siri just try and unitarize itself, something like that. So another possibility was that, okay, maybe that is a sign that really QCD in a planar limit, pure gluing planar limit becomes integrable. That would be possible if at large n, the mass of this particle would go to zero. And finally, which looks the most promising and most interesting, the second one is interesting, but it's too interesting. But the third one, I think maybe it's not completely crazy, but maybe it tells us something about UV asymptotics of a QCD string. Maybe it tells us what I was trying to advocate in the beginning, that theory becomes integrable in the UV. By the way, so this phase shift, e to the is, it has very simple geometric meaning. It's just telling you that when you have a string, a relativistic string, that the length of the string is proportional to energy of the excitation. So that's one intuition why it's natural to expect that maybe if theory becomes simple in the UV, then it will just exhibit phase shifts like that. So it's kind of only geometry left over. So as far as the second option goes, so Mike and Andreas, they looked at the data for high n, and they found that the mass of the state stays the same. So that's, by now, this is excluded. So the theory doesn't become integrable, at least in pure glue, not surprisingly, doesn't become integrable. So we're kind of left with either numerology or third option. And being optimistic, we can formulate combining what one sees in 3D and 4D, we can formulate which one may think of a Stroman proposal for future lattice simulations, proposal for the structure of the QCD string in 3 and 4 dimensions. So in both cases, we have a theory, the simplest explanation of what one sees both in 3 and 4 dimensions would be, in both cases, one have a theory just of Goldstones and massive antisymmetric OD minus 2 tensor. So antisymmetric OD minus 2 tensor in for D equal 4 is just a pseudoscalar, which we found here. For D equal 3, it means nothing, but it's just theory, but the theory is deformed. And it's such that it's integrable UV asymptotics, It becomes integrable in the UV with these asymptotics for S matrix. So that would be the explanation for that coincidence of coupling constants. I think one use of this proposal that it's something concrete which one can try to check now with future lattice data. But on the other hand, what I'm trying to think now, so let's say that that's the answer. It may very well maybe that we'll have to modify it, but let's say that would be the answer. So can we say anything about glue balls in this? So coming back to the second question, so if one knows everything about long strings, because observationally it's much easier to get data about short strings just because they are short, and one measures on the lattice kind of correlators between operators. For heavy operators, for long strings, the things become exponentially small, and it's very hard to measure them. That's why there are much more data about spectrum of heavy glue balls. So we could establish a connection between what we know about long string, and we can directly connect it to test in the glue ball data. That would be really great. So that's what we're trying to think now. And before I conclude, I'll just show you a glimpse. It's the hallucination level at the moment, but just a glimpse of idea which shows in what direction we're thinking now. So that the way of thinking is, well, we're trying to compare like non-critical strings to something like a Higgs mechanism. So famously, there are two problems with bosonic strings, with non-critical bosonic strings as applied to QCD. So first, there is a tachyon. But second, if one looks at the spectrum of states at the first level, then one finds for open strings, one finds massless vector. For closed strings, one finds massless graviton and B field. And in QCD, there are no such things. They are massive. So one needs some extra states to add to the theory, so to make these guys to heavier. By the way, interestingly, in any number of dimensions, so this problem exists, so that's requirement. So in critical strings, what one says, one lives with these massless guys, and that fixes D equal to 26. But in any other number of dimensions, there is no problem for high excited states. So if one looks at the, say, light quantization spectrum of massive strings, one finds that even though naively, this way the series is constructed, there are just OD minus 2 multiplets there, but they arrange in the full multiplets of OD minus 1. But for the first level, they remain multiplets of OD minus 2. So in critical strings, one says, oh, they should be massless, and OD minus 2 is a little group. So that's not an option for QCD. For QCD, we should make these guys massive. And so if one have a vector of OD minus 2, so there are roughly two options, two simplest options how to make it massive. So one is to add a scalar such that this vector, this scalar becomes longitudinal part of the vector, and so it becomes a massive vector. And that's roughly what happens in linear dilaton series. That's also one starts with, in terms of OD minus 2 meta contact, one has a vector plus scalar, and together it's the same as a vector of OD minus 1. So this can be a massive. But however, there is another option, namely, so if one starts with a vector, one can add to this vector antisymmetric tensor and turned into the massive antisymmetric tensor with respect to OD minus 1. So vector, the way vector becomes massive here is that it's kind of, instead of being eaten, instead of eating a scalar, it's get eaten by a two-form field, and the whole thing becomes massive. So what happens in QCD, it looks more like this second option, and what we're trying to do now, we're trying kind of taking this picture semi-seriously, so can we at least to understand the pattern of quantum numbers of the glue balls, which one sees on the lattice. Of course, the challenge is that we're dealing here with D equals 3 and D equals 4, where all these things becomes very degenerate. So, but that's the kind of the current situation. To conclude, given this is a colloquium. This was supposed to be a colloquium. I'm not sure how much I succeeded, but it will be somewhat not directly related to the subject, but it's coming back to my title. Being a phenomenologist, I'm somewhat disappointed by what happened to 750 GGV boson, although it's still well may change. Well, not as far as 750 GGV boson is concerned, but as far as new physics at LHC is concerned. But on the other hand, being a theorist, I always hope that there will be new physics, but that will be well, somewhat hard to decipher. So it will be something, somewhat a puzzle. So there will be time, so that will not have to just chase ambulances, and there will be lots of time to think and understand something. And clearly it looks like there is such a puzzle. So the absence of new physics at LHC is this kind of a puzzle. It looks like a very hard question. But well, my feeling that it may be too hard a question for us to address at the moment, because with physics one usually it's easier to make progress when there is data. On the other hand, well, it looks like there are existing puzzles at low energies, such as like 750 MeV boson, which is, well, the physics of QCD strings, for instance. And I feel that, well, addressing those puzzles, they may be more, still more easier than the one why we don't see new physics at the LHC. And I think, well, I will feel kind of ashamed if people 20 years from now will sort it out, and I didn't even give it a try. So that's kind of my motivation for doing what I'm doing. And as I already said, well, definitely people from older generations gave it a proper try to this question of QCD string, at least. But right now is a good time to think about it, because we really have an additional advantage of that lattice data, lattice techniques, they're really matured. So we have a massive amount of high quality data. And so that gives extra hint about what's going on here. So thank you.
Yeah, so you seem to imply near the beginning of the talk that this theory definitely exists, even though it violates a lot of expectations. For example, there should not be a UV fixpoint in this theory.
Yeah, I don't have a...
What's your basis for thinking the theory exists?
No, the basis for the theory that it exists is what I already said. So we know how to get these numbers from the computers. So people do measure these things, and they definitely see.
But the statement that there exists a theory is a bit stronger than anything you could show on a computer. I mean, you want to show that the theory really makes sense, I mean, not on the lab.
No, for me, this is really the definition of the theory. There is a well-defined prescription how to calculate these observables, and it looks like this prescription converges to definite numbers.
Well, okay, so want some evidence that it's converging. I mean, when you showed the lattice results,
right.
To what extent are those demonstrated to be in?
Yeah, there's clearly continuum limit there.
Really? And I mean, I didn't see anything in the graph.
I didn't try it yet. But people who do it, they check that these are not lattice artifacts. They do check
okay,
that.
So maybe say a few words about that. Why are you sure?
Well, the people check that these are not lattice artifacts. They check that there is a continuum limit. Okay. And I should say lattice, not only for pure glue, but also for actual real world QCDs, very successful now for calculating proton mass. If I remember right, percent accuracy.
Yeah, but
here there are no quarks. So here, from calculational point of view, it's actually something, you don't need supercomputers to do this simulation. So you can really, I did some of this on my laptop. So
there can be artifacts which are only logarithmic, and they will totally kill this theory, right? In the UV, and you will never see them on the computer, right? Of any reasonable size. So I don't find that very convincing.
No, as I said, for me, it's a physicist proof that this thing exists. So it looks, there is a procedure which, there is a well-defined algorithmic procedure. You take a computer and calculate numbers, and you definitely see that if you take the lattice two times smaller or n two times larger, you see that these numbers converge to definite values.
I think I can find you many examples where people thought something existed because of a computer or an experiment.
Yeah.
And with a bit more thought, they realized it absolutely could not exist.
So well,
it's not.
That would be very interesting on its own, but I have a hard time to see how it would happen here.
Maybe if you go back to the picture where you showed the results of the blue balls.
Right.
You know, that because you're saying this is our the great thing we have, which previous, you know,
well, recently. First of all, this is really something which these long string measurements, they're much harder than glue balls, mm-hmm. again, because these are long things, so they require more computer power. Mm-hmm. But also glue ball data now is very good, so that was much more.
Okay, so what kind of error bars are on those?
Well, as I said, it's at the percent level.
So they can only go to SU16.
Yeah, they go through, yeah.
And so how do you extrapolate to infinity if you
can? Well, one compares SU16.
So see some
it's kind of known for many of these quantities that like 1 over n convergence kicks in really fast, and there are some. Kind of some extrapolating, but if you just compare values to SU8, SU12, SU16, mm-hmm. you just don't see that they don't change much. So
somehow what's giving you encouragement is you think this pattern looks simple, but to me,
it
looks like a big mess.
This one looks like a big mess. So yeah, and one should be realistic with what to expect. I think it could have been that this theory is really pure glue. It would be really simple, and one can just calculate these numbers from first principles. Mm-hmm. I think that would translate to the Wolfschmidt theory being integrable. Mm-hmm. So we have now, I think this looks like quite a bit of a mess, so there are splittings here, mm-hmm. But also we now have a proof that the Wolfschmidt theory is not integrable. So what we're trying to do now, we're trying to say, okay, maybe it looks that maybe this deformation from integrability, maybe it's a soft one. So maybe it's kind of the pattern of quantum numbers here would be described by that integrable theory, which we're thinking about. And then there should be some perturbative ways to calculate deviation from this integrability.
But you are introducing free parameters, new free parameters, in your description of this pattern.
Well,
you're introducing additional free parameters.
So for instance, parameters are like the mass.
Yeah.
For instance, the mass of the the mass of the width of this guy.
Right.
That's a new parameter,
right.
But which you can make. But you have many cross checks. It's always the case. So you can use some of the levels to measure these things.
How many predictions compared to the number of parameters?
Well, so here I have two parameters, but really, just even on this plot, of course, the improvement of the just chi squared when you go from like these two lines. These are the wrong ones, but sorry.
Yeah, but it's a slippery slope. When you start to introduce new parameters in what was such a clean problem.
No, but here, for instance, one has prediction. So here one has a cross-check. So here we see this particle at rest. Mm-hmm. But then if you have it at rest, there should be a state where it's boosted. Mm-hmm. And this is a state with different quantum numbers. Mm-hmm. And you see the state, and you see that particle there. Mm-hmm. I don't think maybe it's slippery slow, but I don't think it's different from any other place in physics. So sometimes we're real lucky and get something like harmonic oscillator, mm-hmm. or like e to the s or sine Gordon, some theory which is solvable. Mm-hmm. But it's very rare the case that that's true for a theory you care about. But on the other, there's a hope is that still there is some structure here which is captured by that solvable theory, and one should expand, one should do some kind of perturbation theory around that. So, I think.
But are you confident that when you look at something else, you won't need more parameters? Is there any indication that this would be the complete set of parameters to describe?
No, but it's something which
you infinity.
No, that's why I said so. Well, this. This is a strong man assumption about the theory. So far, it was limited set of things measured. So it could be that when one extends measurements of long strings, one finds that there are extra excited states, and maybe one would find more and more of them that would be then go in the direction, for instance, which Joe advocated, that the theory becomes infinitely messy. I think it still would be interesting because, again, for me, well, barring some surprises that somehow things will stop converging at like SU20, it like looks that this set of numbers which one can really determine operationally, so it's interesting to understand what is the structure there. Mm-hmm. So it would still be interesting, manage to relate these numbers to global spectra, then there is really a huge amount of data here and huge number of cross checks which one can make. So I think there is a reasonable hope that the structure is sufficiently well constrained. But I don't think it's any different from any other situation in physics, because we, that's what we always do. We find to sum something which is relatively ordered, and it's very rare that it's exactly solvable, but then we kind of find some nice system which is a good approximation, which gives a structure, and then, okay, we try to expand around it. So that's where we were. And it may be that one made the wrong choice and kind of... but that's basically the difference between interesting and boring systems. In interesting systems, there is some interesting dynamics which going on which can be described. And boring systems are just messy. And so our hope here that this is an interesting system.
But meaning, does that mean there will be a finite number of parameters which describe SU infinity QCD?
Well, I hope there is a finite, because one may define parameters in a different way, right? So, for instance, if one thinks about like some transcendental number like pi, one may say, oh, there is infinite number of parameters which are digits. I hope that if one looks at this in the correct way, then there is a finite number of parameters. Well, because this theory is a very, to describe this theory, there is a very minimal amount of structure. So it's a SVN gauge theory. So in that sense, all these parameters.
What stops you writing down higher derivative terms in the Lagrangian?
Well, there are these higher derivative terms, but I think about these higher derivative terms as about digits of pi. So if one tries to describe the system kind of in the not adequate way, then it looks like there is infinite number of parameters. But then there is some function which describes like there is a scattering amplitude in this theory, and the question is so to find the proper language to characterize this function, which it, and definitely like the coefficient in front of individual term of the in the high dimensional operators, that's not going to be the right language. But again, I think that's why it's interesting question, because this is a relatively simple system where we can approach this in a very concrete way, and there are good reasons to think that there's more like gravity, maybe something like that. So again, given these analogies, which one finds here? So yes.
Is there any information about what can happen to this axiom when the string ends on the Wilson line or something like that?
String ends. Well, there is there were simulations for open strings just with infinitely heavy ends, like something like a D0 brain, like a heavy quark. And there one sees the same state definitely in the bulk, but I guess what you're asking is more like, because then one can measure things like the boundary S matrix or something like how this axiom interacts with the boundary. There's no reason why that cannot be done, but there was no measurements like that. Yeah.
So in real QCD, quarks matter in the sense that Fox tubes break apart and produce pions and so on.
Yeah.
How does that fit with this picture? Is that all thrown away in the 1/NC?
Yeah, it's suppressed in 1/N. So okay, most ambitiously, the goal would be if one wants to apply it to real world, which, well, frankly, I don't care that much about real QCD at this point, because I think the interesting aspect of the theory is already here. So real QCD led us to think about the series. But if one wants to do that, then in principle, well, optimistically, there is a path to achieve that. So if one understands infinite and limit of this theory, then one can also talk about the spectrum of open strings, and that would describe mesons. But my attitude at this point, in particular, one relating this to real QCD, one thinks that n is sufficiently large, one would think that also for n equals 3 QCD with quarks, there should be such an excitation, then one would expect something like if one starts with a meson with sufficiently large momentum and adds this particle on a flux tube, but there would be prediction for patterns of spectra of hybrid mesons. So one can try to do that, for me personally, that's I don't care that much about that. I think at the moment it's more interesting just to kind of focus on the structure which is present here and in the least complicated setup, and it definitely looks like pure glue is more adequate for that.
Okay. What sets the scale? 750 MeV?
Well, it's lambda QCD is roughly it's twice there. It's roughly half of the mass of the lightest global, twice the string tension. So it's all. There's one scale for lambda QCD.
In the theory you're working with, you've made that theory somewhat similar to our QCD.
That was the question. Yeah, so I set the string tension to the physical string tension for.
Could have been 750 G.
Sorry?
It could have been 750 G.
It wasn't really a motivation for fixing the string tension to be the physical one. It's a different theory.
No, there is one mass scale here, right. which is, yeah, right. But it just, well, because the theory is not infinitely far from QCD, so it's, well, yeah, so.
Any other questions or comments? No, just